Hey, it's Brooke. I just wanted to let you know there's some graphic details and adult language in this episode. Enjoy.
Hello, people. I'm Anthony DePippo. I have been wrongfully convicted for 20 years of a rape and murder I did not commit. I did three trials. Finally was vindicated on October 11, 2016. And I am an integral part of the Innocence Network and the Innocence Movement.
Hi, I'm Brooke, and you're listening to Actual Innocence, a podcast bringing awareness to wrongful conviction and problems within the justice system. I'm here with my superstar co-host, DeMarco. How are you today?
Oh, yeah, I'm pretty good.
I heard that you had an exciting opportunity coming up with StoryCorps. Can you tell us a little bit about that, or is that a secret?
No, it's not a secret. It's something I'm looking forward to. February, either the 8th or the 14th. I'm not sure of the date, but I'll be recording on StoryCorps.
So I realize this is our last real episode for the rest of the year. Does it feel like our season 3 has gone by this quickly to you?
No, it went by pretty fast. Seemed like it just started.
Yeah, I know. And when I go to number our episodes, I was noticing that this is episode 312, but we had a couple of half episodes. So we've been a team for quite a while, and I can't say that I'm sad about that. I'm really glad that you're part of this podcast now.
Yes, I'm happy to be a part of it too.
So let's talk about our sponsors. I am so excited. I have been waiting to talk about Design My Soap since our call that we had with Mohammed. He was so nice, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah, he was real cool.
I just discovered it when I went to their website. It's designmysoap.com. And I love everything about the product and the company. And basically, they're the little guy. And they're trying to make a difference like us. So DeMarco and I had a phone call with one of the three men who started designmysoap.com. And he was so nice. If you have been listening to me for a while, you know that integrity and respect really matter to me and a sponsor, and this company has both of those.
Their life's work was making all natural soap. They discovered that even though pork wasn't a part of their diet, they were still using it. Was an ingredient in their store-bought soap. So instead of going in their bodies, it was going on their bodies. They saw a problem, and so they came up with a solution. It's called designmysoap.com.
And I have to say, I love myself a ham sandwich, but there's no way I would willingly rub pork on my body.
No.
But the name pretty much says it all. It's a website, and it lets you create your own bar or bars, like I have, of soap. I ordered two for myself, and I gifted two to DeMarco and family. The website was really fun. It literally was designing the soap, so I chose the scents and the ingredients, and even I got to name them. It felt like a DIY project, only without having to clean up the mess at the end.
How did you come up with the name Super Woke Soap for one of my bars?
Well, that was the one with coffee in it, and I thought it was clever. But I have to give the credit to the name generator. Besides the soap being handcrafted and all the ingredients non-GMO and gluten-free and vegan and cruelty-free, absolutely nothing was harmed in the making of this soap, basically. My favorite bar smells like lavender, and it has oatmeal and activated charcoal in it.
DesignMySoap.com is the world's first online soap-making studio. It doesn't matter if you have dry skin, sensitive skin, oily, or just regular skin, because you can choose your perfect combination.
And each bar is only $8, and shipping is only $5, no matter how much you buy. That means you can buy a lot of soap and get it shipped for $5.
Go to designmysoap.com to design your soap now.
Plus, this might be the coolest special offer to date. When you use the coupon code ACTUAL at checkout, you get a free vegan lip balm with the Actual Innocence logo on it.
Designmysoap.com and use the coupon code ACTUAL at checkout.
Our guest for today is Anthony DePippo. If his name sounds familiar to you, it might be because his case was mentioned by Jeffrey Deskovic when he was on our show earlier in the season. Today's trivia questions are about wrongful conviction in the state of New York. Are you ready for some trivia?
Yes.
Okay. Question one. What is the purpose of the New York Justice Task Force? A. to help those who have been wrongfully convicted get their convictions overturned, B, prosecute any personnel who committed an act of misconduct leading to wrongful conviction, or C, review cases where the convictions have already been overturned by the courts.
Oh, yeah, my answer is C.
You're right. The answer is C, and this is according to their website. They don't have any power to act on the behalf of someone who has a pending or active conviction. They can only look at a case after it's already been determined that there was a wrongful conviction. Okay, next question. How many people have been exonerated by DNA in New York since 1991? A, 10, B, 17, or C, 24?
And because I have several friends from New York who's been exonerated and we've been conversing a lot here lately, I'm going with C again.
You're right. The answer is 24. And in 10 of those 24 cases, the actual perpetrator was identified. And in 9 of the cases where the perpetrator was identified, they had gone on to commit more crimes while an innocent person was sitting in prison. It's unbelievable that this happened so much.
Yeah, it is. It really is. It's a travesty. You know, it's sad that people go through this still to the day after technology and everything that's, you know, been invented. It seems like we wouldn't be going through it as much now.
Exactly. So can you tell us how you made contact with Anthony?
Yes, I met Anthony DiPippo earlier this year in San Diego at the Innocence Conference. And, you know, we met in along with Jeffrey Deskovic and, you know, some other guys. But I met those guys and I was able to sit down with them, talk with them, and we got to party together. So, you know, I had an amazing time in San Diego. Yes, an amazing time. And here's my friend, the big fella, Anthony DiPippo.
Well, you know, I had a normal childhood. Got involved with drugs. This isn't a secret. Of course, it's going to come out in my civil case. Normal kid. You know, I like watching wrestling and I like playing and I like doing these other things. And then one day, you know, I made a couple bad choices. You know, I began using drugs and I wound up with wrong crowds. You know, I was listening to music. I was involved in the culture. I was somewhat of a tough guy. I wasn't out there raping people. I wasn't out there murdering people. No sexual assault stuff. I wasn't breaking into people's homes. But at the same time, you know, I had that attitude. I was a bit of a thug. And I think that's what got the attention of the Putnam Sheriff's Department, in part.
And you grew up not too far. We've talked to Jeffrey Deskovic a couple of times. And you grew up not too far from where he grew up, correct?
Right. Some of the same people that were involved in his case and putting him wrongfully convicted put me wrongfully convicted. You know, we were coming back from a rave in New York City. Me, Dominic Neglia, Andy Krivak, and Andy's brother, we were all together in a car. And it just happened that this girl, Josette, who we know, terrible, tragic, horrible, horrible situation, the worst you can imagine. She had gone missing, and they found her body. At this point, they didn't give any real details of what happened to her, except that they found her skeletal remains. So we're coming back from the city, and we're talking about it in the car, and Dominic was like, he was talking, and we were talking, and we were like, oh, my God, you know whose sister they found? Because we knew the family. And so when we got pulled over that night, you know, long story short, because it was a big night, we went partying, Dominic told the police that we had known something, that, you know, if they could do something for him, he could do something for them. And they took Dominic away, and they, you know, from there on, after a course of about 3 months, interrogations of Dominic Neglia, they beat Dominic Neglia. They told him, you know, you don't have any choice, but you got to help us. He falsely accused 3 people. I was a young man. Dominic was even younger. He was 17 or 18. Andy was 18 or 19. So we're all young kids. We're professional young youths. So when they pulled in Dominic and they were pulling him out of school. They were taking him out of, his job at the Olive Garden so many times that he got fired. He was a chef. They told him, you know, you don't have any choice. You're going to tell us who and what happened. And so Dominic, you know, he didn't want to go to jail. He told them, I did. But then at some point, he said he didn't want to say anything anymore. They wanted to know who was the rest of the people. Now, mind you, none of this ever happened. He says, I don't want to do this anymore. The detective hits him in the head with a pair of handcuffs, according to Dominic Neglia, and punches him and tells him he doesn't have any choice. And the other detective spits on him. William Quick, who I just had a bump in with his son recently, spits on him. And so he's like, fine, well, whatever. Give me money. I'll take Anthony to the city. I'll find out what he knows, and I'll come back to you. Now, this is all out of his head. So he goes back to the police department without talking to me, and he names these three people. Now, from the three people, Detective Castaldo goes to Denise Rose, the girl. You know, obviously, she's the weakest link in the cop's mind because she's a female. This is all at the behest of Danny Stevens. Danny Stevens is a very important name. We'll get into that in a second. They go to Denise Rose. They tell her, listen, we know you witnessed the murder. She's like, I didn't. I was there. I went home. We were in a van. 2 weeks later, they bring her back, and she starts to amend her testimony. And about 3 weeks later, finally, they told her, we're going to charge you with murder if you don't cooperate. So at that point, she's like, well, I got to say it. So she blamed me and Andy of raping this girl in a van. A very important part, the girl was found. This is, I'm sorry to be graphic here, but this is a very integral part of the story. She was found with her hands were tied with rope and underwear was placed in her mouth and a bra was tied around her face. Now, these were facts that the cops gave to Denise Rose. But an important part, which, you know, inconsistent with her statement, is that the bones fell through the rib cage. They thought the hands were tied in the front. The people's anthropologist said the hands were tied in the back. So Denise says Andy tied the girl's hands in the front and that he attacked her for a minute and a half and then I attacked her for a minute and a half while Bill McGregor and Adam Wilson are just sitting there high on drugs watching. And then we supposedly had dumped the body in the woods. But there was another guy running around out there. His name was Howard Gombert. This is a guy who would later ultimately confess to these crimes. I'm a member of the National Registry. This you can look this up. Jury was ready to acquit me 11-1 when I went to my last trial after they heard proof that Gombert did it. Howard Gombert, his modus operandi in 10 cases, 10 victims, he tied their hands behind their back and placed clothing articles in mouth and tied things around their face. So, you know, people that would muffle them, whatever. I don't want to even get that graphic. So he had this serial modus operandi. There was also another witness named Anita Albano. Anita Albano, who is Captain Lou Albano's daughter-in-law. You know, I'm a wrestling fan. I love Captain Lou. Josette get in this guy's car, identified his car, identified him in a photo array as the last person to be seen with Josette Wright on the date she went missing, 15 minutes after she walked out of her house for the last time. It was like a stone's throw away from her home. So it was like, that's the guy. This is the guy. 64 days prior to him doing this, he abducted his other babysitters. He enticed Josette to babysit at that time. Strikingly similar characteristics, blonde hair, blue eyes. Abducted her at knife point, hands tied behind the back, underwear in the mouth, bra tied around her face. Same thing that happened to her. And the cops knew this. They had DNA testing and everything in that case. And they decided not to disclose that to me.
Josette was 12, correct?
She was a 12-year-old girl. And there's nothing in me. I'm not a pedophile. There's no, you know, no sex with children, no sex. Even at that age, 17 and 12, wouldn't have been that unreasonable. I mean, people would be like, yeah, he's a piece of shit, but Howard Gombert was 31. And, you know, that's unreasonable.
And it's my understanding that this was a long process, like from the time that she was killed until, you know, and all of the questioning and jumping back and forth between witnesses, you can't see my air quotes, like it was a long period of time.
Yeah, it was 13 months from the time she disappeared to the time that she was found, and it was an awful situation. Apparently somebody, you know, there was cut brush, there was a makeshift grave, and she was placed under the cut brush. Her clothing was placed on top of her. Some of her clothing was scattered around, and a hunter found her, you know, a guy that was, you know, he was going out to hunt deer, and he was just walking in. You know, he tripped over the skull, and he called the sheriff. He's like, oh, my God, I found this. And Then ultimately, she was identified through dental records as Josette Wright.
Brooke, so what are you doing for New Year's?
Well, this year on New Year's, my aunt is getting married. But I never know what to get someone for the wedding. I like to get the perfect gift, so it really stresses me out.
Did your aunt register with Zola, the reinvented wedding registry? It's free and easy to use and fun.
Oh yeah, I think she did. You're a genius. When I check out her Zola registry, I have access to their wedding details and registry all in one place. I won't even have to leave home. I can even do it on my phone with the Zola Weddings app.
That's right. Plus, if they ask for something that's kind of expensive, you can use group gifting. That's where everyone pitches in for a big item.
I love that they price match and that they have free shipping. Plus, the little personalized notes are a nice touch. Now I can understand why my aunt needs 3 little pig planters.
It's easy. To sign up with Zola and receive a $50 credit towards your registry, go to zola.com/actual.
That's zola.com/actual to sign up with Zola and receive a $50 credit towards your registry. And what led the police to even suspect you at all was this false, like, coerced witness, correct?
Right. Well, you know, it started from Dominic Neglia. And, you know, he just came home from prison himself. He was the most credible witness. He doesn't have the most credible background, but he was the most credible witness in the case. Literally after he was testifying, while he was testifying, the jury was looking at me with tears in their eyes. So continuing from Dominic Neglia, they went to Denise Rose. They eventually ultimately got her to say that she saw this thing in some crazy scenario, hands tied in front. We already established that the anthropologist said that the hands were tied in the back. Very important part, because the cops were under the mistaken impression that they, you know, the hands were tied in front because the ribs, the finger bones fell through the rib cage. So the hands were definitely tied in the back. The rope went around her neck and back up to the single leg. Now we have 10 girls. 3 of them were allowed to testify. 1 was 7 and 1 was 8. Now the Howard Gombert was doing this still. So this guy is a monster. This guy is a monster. And I do want to continue on Howard Gombert, but we're talking about Denise Rose. And so from Denise Rose, the cops went to Adam Wilson. After 15 hours of interrogation with Detective Patrick Castaldo, who was indicted for lying, William Quick, and Daniel Stevens, who ultimately took Jeffrey Deskovic's lie detector test, the one where he falsely got him to confess to a crime that he didn't commit, that a man named Stephen Cunningham actually committed, and the DNA proved that Stephen Cunningham committed, had Adam Wilson in the room. And you know, was telling Adam Wilson, you can't go home unless you sign a statement. Told him he lied, even though he passed. And told Adam Wilson, and this is a lie detector test. This is a tool of intimidation. This guy, Danny Stevens, is a creep. He's a creep. And, you know, that's the truth. And I look at him, and you know, he's got a big following on Facebook. People like him. And I just, to those, all those people that act like this piece of garbage, he's framing innocent people. We're kids. They took our lives. Like, I could have been the World Wrestling Federation champion. Who knows what Andy could have been? Maybe I could have been dead in a ditch, got high from drugs. But that was my right.
But you didn't have that opportunity.
Danny Stevens, piece of shit. And if I could tell Danny Stevens he's a piece of shit to his face, I would love to do that. I have to be civil about it, because now I'm suing him. But, yeah, they can ask me, is Danny Stevens a piece of shit? And I could testify affirmatively. With a lie detector on my arm, actual lie detector, not one of the bullshit ones that Danny does, and I can say, Danny Stevens is a piece of shit, and it will register true. Mm-hmm. You know, I love Jeff. I see Jeff every week. I know you see me on Facebook. We're hanging out. We're having a good time. Jeff is a good-hearted dude, man, and he's somebody that I look up to in many ways.
Can you tell us what your first interaction with the police was like?
Yeah, no. Danny Stevens had me hooked up to the lie detector test, and I wanted to take it. I'm like, you're accusing me of murder. And this is before Denise Rose came in the picture, Zach or Dominic. They wanted me to take the test. And I said, well, if I take the test, then they're going to know. I had nothing to do with this. And even at that point, you know, I was under the influence of so many things. There were so many risk factors, but I was willing to take that chance because I wanted the cops to know. Listen, Cristaldo picked me up today. He surrounded me, three cop cars and himself. It was January 5th, 1995, I believe. He picked me up. And when he handed me the card and I looked at him, and he asked me, he's like, listen, do you know anything about this missing girl? You know, call to the street, just don't say anything. But for this matter, if I did know, if I knew about Howard Gombert, if I knew what he was doing to these girls, I would have absolutely told him, and I would have, you know, I wouldn't have had nothing, and my people wouldn't even have looked at me twice. I would have definitely gave him the information, but I really didn't. And so when he dropped me off, he gave me a ride to the end of the road. He gave me his card. I kept the card. And I'm like, okay, you know, if I ever find anything out, I'll tell you. Because that's abhorrent to any sense. If you're a gangster, if you're a drug dealer, if you're a thug, nobody wants to see these kids. I mean, anything happened to these kids. I feel so bad about what happened to her. There's not a day that goes by that I don't wish that I could go back in time and just get in the time machine and stop Howard Gombert from abducting her. But I can't do that.
Did they offer you an attorney or did you ask for one?
I did a few times and they said, fuck you and fuck your attorney. We got a murder case here. They were trying to break me. And at one point, they threatened me with a death sentence. I didn't know if there was a death sentence in New York. They threatened me with a death sentence. And I said, I don't care, or something to that effect. And that's memorialized. They took notes off that. And I meant that when they said that. Listen, you can put me on death sentence. I'm not committing to some crazy shit that you're talking to me about. But I'm the only one that wasn't afraid to say that to the cops. The other four people involved gave statements. And I would like to get into Adam and Bill a little bit more. I love Bill. I love Adam. I've seen them both since I was home. They're great people. And they stand behind us. Dominic falsely accused three people. He falsely accused Adam Wilson, Bill McGregor, and Denise Rose. Now, they got Denise Rose to say that she was there. They also got Adam to sign a paper, but the night that Adam signed the paper, after his experience, his lie detector test with Dan Stevens, he came out. He immediately got a lawyer. He told his probation officer the next step, the very next step. I wasn't there. They made me give a statement. I'm letting you know that, you know, because he was worried about the perjury and everything, that I didn't see that. All that they said that went down, that didn't happen. And so he recanted immediately. With Bill McGregor, they came to him. They told him, they said he was a witness to an accident, and they wanted to meet with him in a coffee shop. And at that point, when they met with him, he was surrounded by New York and Putnam County police officers. And Putnam County is two counties up. The night Josette got killed, but they pulled him into the police station. And from that point, they were trying to tell, they acted like we signed a statement on him that blamed him, and they showed it to him. And when he asked to see it, they crumpled it up and threw it in the garbage. And he said, okay, I saw it. I didn't see nothing, but I was there. I fell asleep. That's all he was willing to consent to. He was like, they just said, we only want you to put him in a van. That's all you got to do. So he put us in a van, and then, you know, he was addicted at that time to many different drugs. He was a young guy. He was a crushable youth. And he just took the easy way out for that time. I love Bill. Bill is one of my favorite people right now today. And I'm friends with him. And he will stand to the death with us. It took him a few years to come forward. But, you know, at the first trial, he testified that he was there and he fell asleep in the van. And he feels bad about that. And we had words. I mean, he was literally in tears when he saw me. I love the guy. He's a great guy. He's got a great family now. He's got a great wife. He's living the good life in Florida. I follow him on Facebook, and I look at him, and every time I see him, it kind of brings me a tear of joy, even though that happened, you know, because I respect it. I respect it. He had a hard time with the police. He made a bad choice, but he was willing. He risked 7 years in prison. He took the stand. The lawyers, the judge, the DA, at the second trial, because remember, I had three trials. The second trial, they were trying to tell him, we're going to charge you with perjury. And he's like, fuck it, put me on a stand. I'm getting this done now. Whatever's going to happen is going to happen. And he wore that like an H on his chest, and he got up there, and he did awesome. Both last two trials, he did awesome. So, I mean, I respect my man. I love my man. I just wanted to know that.
Marco, I'm so excited. I just scored a ticket for two very different shows using the SeatGeek app on my phone. Fan of the opera, I love a good musical, and Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, which is one of my favorite podcasts. It's practically going to be in my backyard. Finding the tickets were so easy. I was waiting in a long holiday line at the grocery store, but with just a few taps, I instantly found my seats.
Well, SeatGeek is designed to make your ticket buying experience easier than ever. It saves you time and money by searching multiple ticket sites. It compares the prices and finds amazing deals.
SeatGeek grades every ticket based on value. That makes it easy for me to identify the best seats in my price range. Plus, every purchase is guaranteed, so I can enjoy the experience instead of stressing about it.
Listeners, you should check it out too, because best of all, our listeners get $20 off their first SeatGeek purchase. Just download the SeatGeek app and enter promo code ACTUAL today.
That's promo code ACTUAL for $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase.
So when you were arrested, you were a young kid and you're in a county jail for rape.
Yes.
How did that make you feel?
Well, with the other guys weren't too happy with me.
And that's what I mean. You know, how were you accepted?
I had to fight my way politically. You know, I used the politics. I'm a big guy. I was ready to bust anybody in the head that looked at me wrong. Like, if you look like a piece of popcorn lifting all the weights, look like a piece of popcorn in a shirt, I don't care. If you're going to call me out, that was going to be it. And I had that mindset my entire bid. God, you know, bless me. I was never really confronted. I don't got no cuts in my face. I never signed in a PC. I never ratted on nobody. But eventually I had enough information, like I'm telling you, because it's kind of a crazy story. And we're only getting to the tip of the iceberg here. That guys, I was able to go to a few guys, the Italians, blood dudes, Muslims, everybody. Anybody that was able to ask me, I had all this recantation. They were like, that's it. He's with us. So when I moved through the prison, it was like they knew I had a fucked up charge, but they respected me because the other inmates respected me. And I was able to move through with a lot of ease, at least through to the first trial. I had problems in my second trial because it got really rough and I got tired of telling the story.
How long did you have to wait between the time that you were arrested and you got your first trial?
The period in the jail from the first, you're talking about the first trial, is only about 14 months. You want to talk about the second trial, it was 16 years. What happened was my lawyer was a guy named Bob Leader. I have issues with him since the time I met him. I think I made my bones with him.
Was he a paid attorney?
Yes, he was a paid attorney, but he was also the head of legal aid. But we paid him $67,000 to represent me at the trial. He received a bunch of discovery material. Howard Gombert was his former client, and he had one, if not two, previous cases where he represented him on rape charges, where the hands were bound behind the back. We know definitely one. We think there was two. We didn't get that far. We'll find out in discovery coming up, civil stuff, that he represented Howard Gombert. And when we hired him, he didn't know that Howard Gombert did this. But then the district attorney plopped on his table all this discovery material, the eyewitness account, red car, Connecticut plates, last seen, identification, photo array. He never said nothing to me, and he never said nothing to the DA, and he never said nothing to the court. So we found out through happenstance that he previously represented him and that he received the discovery material and that he should have told the court so the court could assess whether I was willing to forego the risk inherent in conflict-free representation. Because he didn't, I got my first reversal.
So, okay, let's go back just a second. So after your first trial, was that a jury trial?
Yes, all my trials were jury trials.
How long did your first trial last?
It was about 4, maybe 5 weeks. You know, the DA put on 2.5 weeks or 3 weeks worth of testimony, and then we came back, we put our witnesses on. And, you know, the conflicted lawyer, he really did a good job with what he had. It was just that it wasn't enough. They still had Bill. we weren't able to present Dominic at that time. We moved to present him because he recanted also his confidential information, falsely accusing us and making up the story. The judge wouldn't allow it in because somehow the judge, Judge Bratz, who passed away, said that he didn't believe it. So it took us, you know, Dominic didn't testify to the third trial. So the first trial was like 5 weeks. The jury deliberated for like 5.5 hours. It was a Friday. Back then, they used to sequester the jurors, and that would mean they would have to stay in a motel room, and they wouldn't have to have that, you know, luxury of going home. And they didn't want to go to the motel room. And there were some people that were crying on that jury. So I wasn't sure if they were making the right choice in their mind. And, you know, I was convicted.
How much time did you receive?
It was 25 to life for the murder. And I had a separate case, was possession of PCP, which I was guilty of. Like I said, I was using drugs. I got 4 to 12 on top. So it was 29 to life.
And so they had these so-called witnesses' testimony. Did they have any kind of physical evidence? Like I'm wondering what the prosecution's case was besides witnesses.
No. There was no DNA. And later on, the attorney general would step in with the district attorney, ready to throw my case out. Judge Judy's son, Adley, he was a guy that, you know, I was filing an appeal. He said it was his hope I took my last breath in jail. He wasn't a DA when I got convicted the first time, but he was when I was tried the second time and convicted. He told the public media that it was his hope that I had my last breath in jail. But then one of the victims came forward, the babysitter from 64 Days Prior. I don't want to say her name. And I came to him and I wrote him a letter. My lawyer is Mark Baker. Mark Baker represented John Gotti, subway vigilante Bernard Getz. He works with Ben Brockman. He's been an attorney for 40-something years, and he's one of my best friends today. He told me, listen, Anthony, don't write the district attorney about nothing. You want to say something, let me say it. And I wanted to say what I wanted to say. So I wrote him a letter, and I didn't expect him to respond. I said, can you please help me? I'm innocent. Can we get this DNA from this case? And within 2 weeks, he's calling my lawyer. He called the New York State Attorney General, and they're, like, essentially ready to throw my case out. This guy indicted Patrick Costaldo for lying. The same detective that was the lead detective, even more than Stevens, he was Stevens' bulldog, was ready to, you know, co-sign my motion to vacate. They, you know, pretty much my motion for the bail on a third trial, which actually I came home off of, was co-written by the attorney general and the former district attorney.
Okay. What happened with the other guys who were arrested? Were they also tried and convicted?
No. But they, I mean, under the law, they were accomplices as a matter of law and as a matter of fact. And under the law in New York State, if you are, you know, if you're there and there's things that, you know, you could have did and didn't do, there was a charge. Even if they didn't get charged criminally, the jury should be charged. And there has to be some independent corroboration from that. And in this case, only Ben Brockman had seen that up to that point. Like all my lawyers, they didn't never seen that. So we went to trial without that extra charge that we could have got the jury.
When the jury came back with the guilty verdict, how did that make you feel?
I mean, your life is over. Both times. There's no explanation for that. DeMarco, you know more than anybody.
Oh, I do know.
Guilty verdict.
Yeah.
That's the end of life, really, right there. But at the same time, you live those couple of weeks and you start to see, you know, I got to move forward. So I was going to prison. And when I got to prison, I was depressed, you know, the first couple of months. But I said, you know what? I'm going to make the most of my life. And I was just telling a friend of mine the other night, you know, there's days, and DeMarco, you could probably identify me with me on this. There are days that I miss being with those guys. You know, if I had a couple hours to go back in there or go back on the block and just so I could talk to them and hang out with them, I would do that. You got to make the most of what you got. So at the point when they say, oh, you're guilty, you're going to prison for murder, your life ain't over, but it feels like it. I mean, they're taking everything from you. You know, I'm 22. You know, I went in 20 years old. I don't know. I don't really know other way to respond to that.
In those 16 years between your first trial and your second trial, where did you spend your time? Was it all in the same facility or?
My first 8.5 years I spent in Chemongong. Then I went to Attica, infamous Attica. I spent 5.5 years there. And while I was in Attica, and even in Chemongong, you know, I had a decent bed. Notwithstanding my conviction, guys accepted me. You know, I was cooking. Even the guards accept me. I was allowed to cook in my cell. Not everybody could cook in their cell. You know, had a DVD player, had a TV.
I've heard that when you're in prison, you know, if you have a TV or that sort of thing, that it has to be clear. Is that true?
It's everything that you order in prison, typewriters in New York State, Walkmans. We still got cassette tapes, TVs. It's all, you could see through it. You could see the electronics. It's clear. But, you know, it still works the same.
During that time, did you have contact with your family? Like, were you close with your family?
I called my mom almost every day. And I would get a visit. You know, when I was closer, it would be every other week. And then when I went up top, it was every one out of the 2 or 3 months. But they sent me money and they make sure I look good. And I had the power to investigate. So I was able to send whoever I needed to send wherever, what state, wherever they were at. You know, I had that power, which nobody really ever has. I had the great lawyers, and I had, my family was so supportive. Because they know, and they just wanted me to come home. I don't know if they know what to do with me now that I'm home, because I'm a little bit nuts, but they gave their heart and soul to get me out of prison.
So what would you say that you did to some of the things you did to maintain your sanity or stay strong?
You want to be honest, the first 10 years I did drugs. I'm in prison, I'm serving life, and I didn't do it. I was a drug addict when I went in. I was still a drug addict, and to tell you the truth, I was talking to a friend of mine the other day, and I'm looking back on it. You know, I did these drugs, but they helped me. They motivated me to want to look at the law. So I would do the drugs, and I would read the law, and I would type while I was on the drugs. And it made me feel good because, you know, I was in another state, and I think that correlation gave me, like a spiritual power that I wouldn't have had if I wasn't using. But eventually, I had to stop. And I still kept going. I didn't have the same motivation that I had, but I had a different motivation at that point, and people were helping me. But really going into it, yeah, you know, I was heavily under the influence the first 10 years.
Can you tell us what the main steps were in getting your second trial? Like, what led to it?
Okay, so this is an integral part right here. A guy named Joe Santoro was in Connecticut prison, and he told, you know, he said that Howard Gombert, you know, said that he did this, and also with Robin Murphy. During my second trial, which was reversed based on the proof of Howard Gombert's guilt, the eyewitness identification and those matters, and the attorney's conflict of interest, I got a second trial. And during the second trial, we came to knowledge of an individual who had spoken to Howard Gombert. Now, this is the second person that said Howard Gombert killed this girl and another girl. I want to get into that in a little bit. The Court of Appeals decided that, you know, that was enough. I should have been able to present that. The second trial, even though I was reversed on the proof of Gombert's guilt, the second trial said, you can't say the name Howard Gombert to the jury. Like, that's ridiculous. You're sending me back down on that count, and you have the guy in the red car, Connecticut plates with the victim, and this kind of, you know, he had this modus operandi, and we're offering it, and you say, that's not enough. So when I came back the second time, the Court of Appeals pretty much ripped the judge apart in their ruling and said, almost established, like almost found this fact that this guy confessed to killing Josette Wright and Robin Murphy. If I could stop for a minute, I want to talk about Robin Murphy. Robin Murphy was a girl who had gone missing 6 months after Josette. It was about a mile away from where Josette had gone missing. Howard Gombert worked in a laundromat, and she was last seen with this creep. Behind the laundromat, 4 days later, they found her purse, her car keys, and what has been described as her other personal effects. I don't know what they were. In her pocketbook, according to a couple of investigators that were working on the matter, was a dirty, nasty, threatening letter that Howard Gombert had written to another one of his girlfriends that he was trying to get Robin to, like, give to the girl. She was like an in-between between somebody that Howard Gombert, you know, was seeing that he was abusing, and Howard Gombert. A few hours later, Howard Gombert attempts to commit suicide. He ingests sleeping medication and alcohol in such excess that it lands him in the Danbury Hospital for 10 days as a result of kidney failure. Suicide and attempted suicide as forms of consciousness of guilt, similar to flight evidence. So if you, that was a pretty serious attempt. I mean, if you have kidney failure, that means you really tried to do the job. And so Howard goes to the hospital hours after Robin Murphy disappears. Now the cops see him. They said, were you with Robin Murphy at this laundromat that night where she was last seen? And he says, yes. But he tries to say, well, she went off in this car or that car and this, that, and the other thing. He's seen soaking wet after whatever he does, trying to go back to her job buying coffee, and then he's running around the shop, right? Like that's going to be some kind of alibi for him. This is a guy who said that Robin Murphy would never be found. He told this to Joe Santoro, just like he told Joe Santoro that the only way he could get Josette Wright in his car was to, tell her he wanted to babysit for her, and that he had sex with her around the time she disappeared. And he asked the time that, that was at the time around that she died. And so Joe Santoro said yes. And this is the jailhouse informant that gave us a statement that was the key piece that brought everything together, other than the 10 girls and his modus operandi with the rope and the underwear in the mouth. So now years later, they would go into Howard Gombert's house and they would find, his suitcase. After he raped an 8-year-old girl, he took an 8-year-old girl in the woods and he did stuff that he did to Josette, to her, and he threatened her with death. And that's why he's got 30 years now, because he did the same thing that this girl, but he didn't kill this girl. He abused her a few times, and then she told her aunt, and he abused her aunt too, and her aunt is friends with me on Facebook, and he's always like, everything and anything I could do for you, I'm going to do. A great person, great people, horrible, horrible situation. And now they have not only an attempted suicide, an admission of being last seen with that victim, they have now DNA proof that Howard Gombert had in his possession a pair of the underwear of a missing girl. We did further testing, and we found out that another one of his victims, a girl that he was abusing from when she was 7 to 18, tying up with rope, underwear in the mouth, same modus operandi, was in this suitcase. So this was kind of like a trophy suitcase. And also from his rearview mirror, when you look up, that little mirror you have in your car, you look up when you're looking back to see if anybody's behind you. He had, we believe, and what has been informed to us, Robin Murphy's pentagram necklace hanging from that as kind of like another trophy. So these are overwhelming. It's a circumstantial, but it's overwhelming set of circumstances that, this is the guy. And now my co-defendant, who we recently seen, he's in great spirits. He's represented by Peter Neufeld's wife, Adele Bernard. And he was in great spirits. He's still in prison. I'm home. I'm a member of the National Registry. He's still in prison. And, we went to go see him. He's all smiles. But he's still there. He's going to be there through Christmas. You know, he's got to eat Christmas dinner in prison because these pieces of shit in Putnam County, this district attorney, scumbag, Bob Pendy, he don't want to do nothing right. The sheriff's department, I have no respect for these people. And when I speak from my heart, I'm speaking with true anger. I have no respect for these people. They claim that he did it because they want to protect the establishment. They want to keep the machine oiled. They don't want to admit wrong. When all they have to do is say, you know, we're going to have an investigation here. We want to make sure justice was done. But they don't care about justice. All they care about is his conviction. And when I say this, I get really mad. There's people in prison. There's people in prison that deserve to be home.
I agree.
And you can even just look at them. You could just look at them and say, this isn't the man that deserves to be there. You know that they didn't do this kind of thing. And my boy is in prison, and that breaks my heart. And it breaks my heart. And you know, to know that this guy's got the power, I continuously extend the olive branch. I'm like, listen, all you got to do is just open the case up. Anything you need from us, you got it. But they choose not to. They choose not to. This guy gets on TV and says, we did it. And we didn't do it. And he gets on TV and says, well, you don't think there's another killer? He says, no. But he only answers in emails now because there's nothing he can say about me. I'm home now. I'm with Jeffrey Deskovic. I'm with Marty Tankliff. I'm hanging out with The Undertaker. I'm hanging out with Hulk Hogan. I'm hanging out with great people like Jason Flom. I'm getting called out to go to the Mets game, but I don't just go to the Mets game. He calls me out to the Mets game. I'm meeting the Mets on the Mets field. I was hanging out with Barry Sheck. I see Peter Neufeld every week. The Innocence Network accepts me. I'm a member of the National Registry. Why is he still in prison? Why is he still in prison? Well, I'll tell you why. I'm gonna tell you why. It's because these scumbags don't want to admit that there was wrong done. They want to protect each other because one person votes for the other person. They don't want to get sued. They don't want to pay taxpayers money. They don't want to have to make excuses that somebody did wrong. And this is what goes on all across America, is that prosecutors place their own interests above the interests of justice.
We took a natural break at this point in the interview, and because it was so rich with detail, I'm going to divide it up into two parts. But the second part will be ad-free and should be out by the end of the day. Thanks for listening, and Merry Christmas.